This is a critical year for the future of democracy. Half the world's population will go to the polls in 2024, at a time when citizens in America and across the globe are losing faith in democratic institutions, and autocracies like Russia and China are undermining the international system built on democratic ideals. We often view the rollback of democracy and threats to the liberal international order as separate problems, but they are closely interlinked. The Middle East Institute's new podcast explores the interplay between democracy's domestic and international foes, as well as how to counter them. I'm Gönül Tol, and this is Rethinking Democracy. Authoritarian populism is on the rise around the world. Political scientists and policymakers are debating what's driving the trend. Is it economic inequality or a cultural backlash against social change that erodes trust in democratic institutions? On today's episode, we will be discussing the relationship between changing economic conditions and support for democracy, not just in the West, but also in regions facing more stubborn challenges to democratic governance, like the Middle East. Welcome to the third episode of Rethinking Democracy with Gönül Tol. Joining me today is Dr. Daron Acemoğlu and Dr. Tamara Kaufman with us. Dr. Acemoğlu is a renowned scholar of political economy, economic development, and technological change. He's an institute professor at MIT. He's the author of 6 books, including New York Times bestseller, Why Nations Fail: Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. Dr. Wittes is the president of the National Democratic Institute. She has a long record of engagement in democratic development, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa. She served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs during the Obama administration, coordinating U.S. policy on democracy and human rights in the Middle East during the Arab uprisings. Daron, Tamara, thanks for joining me today.
It's our pleasure.
Happy to be here.
Well, the far-right parties are thriving across the West. They made big gains in the European Parliament elections and more recently in French snap legislative elections. Although in France, the left-wing coalition took the most seats in the National Assembly. But still, the far-right party, the National Rally, and its allies made huge electoral gains, securing about 140 seats, about 50 more than they had before. It's a familiar story for anyone watching American politics. The Republican Party is no longer committed to democracy, and it's doing really well in the polls. So it seems like more and more people across the world are embracing authoritarian politics. Daron, let me start with you, and let me start with a theoretical question before we delve into the specifics of each case I just mentioned. When do voters support democratic institutions?
Thank you, Gönül. I only wish I knew the answer to that question. I think it is the million-dollar question. It's also fair to say that as social scientists, we were both caught off guard, and we're still trying to understand why authoritarian leaders have such great appeal. People were probably too optimistic about the chances of democracy. There was the sort of end of history narrative that even if many people, including myself, we never bought into it fully, we were probably influenced by it and thinking that democracy could survive fairly easily as long as it delivered in terms of its basic promises. And I think the events of the last decade or so have called many of these presumptions into question. I still don't doubt my own research findings, as well as supporting evidence from others, that democracies perform better economically, especially for the less well-off segments of society, that authoritarian leaders are often lying and manipulating. But it is quite clear that they have a strong appeal under a variety of circumstances. Whatever those circumstances are, I would also say they're not specific to the US or a few other industrialized nations. The rise of authoritarian leaders is too correlated across the world to be dismissed as a result of a few sort of idiosyncratic events in the United States or the United Kingdom. You know, this is just really very pervasive. So I think when you take all of these things into account, I would say that three related phenomena seem to be the leading candidates, and it's probably a combination of all of those, which is one is that democracy has underperformed relative to the aspirations that it created. In particular, it has underperformed in terms of both growth and fair distribution of resources. Democracies haven't dealt well with cultural issues, which the population obviously cares a lot about, and authoritarian leaders have been much better at forging narratives around cultural issues that threaten mainstream parties. And then finally, I think globalization has shifted balances in a way that democratic governments haven't fully responded to. And I think we have empirical evidence on all of these things that suggest that they are operative, but I'm not sure that we are close to a holistic explanation for these phenomena yet.
So I want to pick up on that. You just talked about how democracy underperformed issues like growth and fair distribution of resources. So in a way, you are saying that people support democracy when democracy delivers economic growth, social and economic stability, and maybe linked to that non-corrupt government, low inequality, and things like that. So Tamar, I want to turn to you. Can non-democracies deliver these things? Daron just talked about briefly how democracies perform better economically than authoritarian systems. But today, actually, autocracies are bigger, they are richer, and they are more technologically sophisticated. And China comes to mind, right? It's by far the biggest non-democracy in economic terms, with a dollar GDP roughly two-thirds of America's. So when it comes to investment and things like innovation, autocracies are now an especially serious rival to democracy. So one could argue that when it comes to economic growth, non-democracies can have great advantages. They can just impose the politically difficult but critically important policies needed to move a society forward economically. So can authoritarian regimes fast track economic growth?
I think there has long been an argument that autocracies can deliver X desired goal better than democracies because autocracies don't have to deal with domestic politics, they don't have to negotiate, they don't have to go through elections, they can make quick decisions, they're agile, and therefore they can deliver things faster, whether those things are a military buildup or industrialization or economic growth. And it may well be true that an autocrat can make policy decisions more quickly than a democratic government, but I don't think it necessarily follows that those decisions yield the results that citizens want. I think two things are important. Number one, citizens are not being asked to choose in most cases, would you like democracy or would you like an autocracy? Most aspiring autocrats don't go before the people who are going to vote for them and say, elect me, I'm going to be a dictator. They say, elect me, I'm going to fight for you. I represent your values. I am going to bring you better material benefits. I am going to make our nation stronger and safer in a dangerous world. And so when people have a choice between democracy and autocracy, they choose democracy. But when people have a choice between candidates, they are looking for the candidate who is going to give them the benefits they're seeking, whether those are material benefits, security benefits, or as Daron said, cultural benefits. that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, I think scholars have dealt fairly thoroughly at this point with the question of whether autocracies are better at economic growth than democracies. I think particularly of Tom Cruthers' seminal piece back in the mid-2000s on the sequencing fallacy, which grew out of the idea that actually democracies are slow and have a tough time making economic policy, and democratic transitions fail in poorer countries. So you really need to focus on building a middle class and driving economic growth. And then, just like Taiwan and South Korea, that middle class will demand government accountability. And Tom does a really good job in that piece, and I think there's plenty of other scholarship on this, showing that, in fact, autocratic governments, for the most part, when they generate economic growth, they generate growth that does not benefit the broad mass of people, as Daron was saying. They generate growth that is unequal and increasingly unequal over time, because in order to sustain themselves in power, they have to pay off alternative power centers. And so, yes, China is delivering growth. It is also massively magnifying inequality across the country. And it is not delivering sustainable growth that allows, for example, middle-class Chinese to buy an apartment that will hold wealth for their children, because the real estate market collapsed because apartment buildings are very poor quality and they collapse. And so it's not working to create distributed growth. So those, I think, are the real vulnerabilities.
So Tamara, you are saying that autocracies might deliver fast economic growth, but that growth is not sustainable and distributed. Daron, in your work, you challenge the view that democratic institutions are irrelevant or they are a hindrance for economic growth. And instead, you argue that wealthy countries become wealthy primarily because of inclusive political and economic institutions. So please explain what you mean by inclusive institutions and how we get there. How do we build inclusive institutions?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I'm saying is sort of consistent with Tamara, but I would go even one step further. And I think even the claim that autocracies can deliver fast growth needs to be looked at very critically. So my work in this area finds that when you look across all the countries in the post-war era, and the same is also true in the 19th century, by the way, but let's just focus on the post-war era, on average, democracies do much better in terms of aggregate economic growth as well. There are, of course, exceptions. Some non-democracies grow very rapidly, but that's generally due to either luck, some special circumstances, or the fact that countries such as, you know, China, after, you know, being held back under Maoist policies, had quite a lot of growth potential that would have been realized under a variety of different forms of government. So democracy, I think, is fairly good in terms of its economic performance. But when I'm talking of the broader long-run economic growth, James Robinson and I coined the term inclusive political institutions because we wanted to emphasize that democracy, or at least the narrow definition of democracy, people going to the voting booth and casting their ballots and some amount of free competition between parties, is not enough. You really need a greater level of political inclusivity whereby different groups are not silenced. There are constitutional and norm-based limits on abuses of power so that you don't get a majoritarian system where you're electing a king for 4 years and then that king does whatever he or she wants. So the inclusivity notion thus captures the precepts of good governance based on who has voice and who has say within the population. So that's what we were trying to get to. So that notion, in some sense, comes from our belief based on historical and statistical evidence that you need expert capable governments, but then you also need to provide those governments with the right incentives and the right constraints. And the best way of doing that is by empowering different groups in society. And that's what the inclusive political institutions notion captures. And also, I'll just add that, of course, that's the sort of an ideal type notion. In reality, no country is a perfect specimen of that. Some of them come close to it, but many, many, many of them are at the other pole, which we call extractive political institutions.
I have a follow-up question on that, but Tamara talked about this issue of sequencing. What's the relationship between democracy and economic growth? The literature says a lot on that. And when it comes to sequencing, do you need, and also what you're referring to create those inclusive institutions, do you need to have a certain level of economic development to be able to build those institutions?
No, I definitely believe that you do not. In fact, I agree very much with what Tamara said. I think both the conceptual foundations and the empirical evidence for the sequencing idea are very, very shaky. First of all, again, from my statistical work, we do not find that democracies perform better at high levels of education or economic development. So no pattern like that emerges from the data. From another sort of cross-country study that we did, we also do not find that higher income or higher education countries are more likely to have stable democracies. So the modernization type ideas, which are closely linked to that sequencing view, don't seem to hold water either. Tamara is 100% right. Much of the type of authoritarian growth that you have experienced in the decades following World War II and in the petrostates later on does not enrich the middle class. So the mechanism of the sequencing view doesn't seem right. And finally, you know, if you look at history from a broader perspective, you see that democratic type institutions, not identical to liberal democracy of the Western form, but democratic type institutions have emerged across a variety of circumstances in the village republics of India, in Africa, parts of Latin America. So there isn't sort of this liberal Western democratic institutions that require high levels of education and big middle class, and they will only come once you reach $10,000 per capita income. That just doesn't seem to receive any evidence from the data.
Well, this is a question to both of you. And I want to go back to the question of increasing support for anti-democratic far-right parties. Although, Daron, as you mentioned, these days you need to clarify what you mean by democracy. Autocrats also come in the name of democracy. So maybe instead of calling these far-right parties that are surging anti-democratic, maybe we should call them anti-liberal. But anyway, I want to go back to that point. Is it fair to say, where do you stand on this question? Is the rise of populist authoritarians primarily driven by economic inequality?
I would say the rise of what I might term illiberal populism. And I think it's important to note that that can exist on the left or on the right. And actually, one of the interesting features of some illiberal populists we see today is that they're, other than being populists, they're kind of ideology free. They don't fit neatly into right-left categories. I would say it's both. It's both economics and culture. And I go back to those three factors that Daron laid out at the beginning. Equal growth or distributed economic growth, security, or, you know, the place in global politics, and culture. And I think all three of these matter. I think that we are living in an era where the assumptions that we had in the 1990s, not just about the sort of inevitable triumph of democratic politics, but also about geoeconomics, about the idea that economic integration would be a rising tide that would lift all boats through free market forces, that's been eroded. And the flow of migration globally, which is at an all-time high, including an all-time high in refugees fleeing from conflict and violence, that has also generated a political impacts, not just in the immediate conflict zones, but far away. For example, the flight of Syrians into Northern Europe and Afghans globally has shifted debates on migration, and it's shifted demographics, and it's therefore shifted political and social realities, even in Western democracies. And so I think some of what you see in this illiberal populism is political entrepreneurs who are taking disappointment about growth and inequality, concerns about corruption, concerns about changes in culture and society, and a sense of insecurity because of the state of the world, and playing on all of those things. These are tools, these are ingredients that illiberal populists use in their political pitch, and that is how they get elected. That doesn't mean that those are issues that can only be solved through illiberal populist policies, but it means that liberal democratic actors need to have compelling arguments and compelling policy ideas for how to solve them. And it means that in the places where we've seen populism take a hit, whether that is France just now or elsewhere, Guatemala, for example, we need to see those democratic governments do a decent job of delivering equitable growth with transparency, accountability, a sense of secure national and communal identity, and basic security.
Tamara, you made a great point, basically saying that both of those factors, it's both economics and culture, and it makes a lot of sense to me because I've always been very skeptical about this idea that the rise of populist authoritarianism is primarily driven economic inequality, because then I ask myself, how do you explain then, if it's primarily economic inequality, how do you explain the rise of anti-democratic parties in places such as Sweden and Denmark, which are affluent societies with cradle-to-grave welfare systems, where you have economically secure populations? And I tend to agree more with those political scientists who argue that, in fact, populist authoritarianism can best be explained as a cultural backlash in Western societies against this long-term ongoing social change. As societies have grown more liberal, as Daron touched upon, more liberal on social issues such as immigration, LGBTQ rights, as they've become more egalitarian about gender roles and racial equality, more secular, so traditionalists feel threatened and left behind. And these older, wider, more rural, less educated segment of society has turned to authoritarian leaders promising to stop that transformation. So maybe also something else to consider, maybe these cultural and economic explanations of the rise of far-right parties are not mutually exclusive.
Definitely not mutually exclusive. And I think, you know, my former colleague at Brookings, Bill Galston, did a wonderful book a few years ago, a short book on populism in Europe, and makes exactly that point.
Yes, it's really interesting because I keep seeing more articles and scholarly debate exclusively focusing on economic side of things. Tamara, you worked closely with the Middle East, both as a scholar and a practitioner. When we look at the region, we see that in the post-colonial period, the state played an unusually important role in economies across the Arab world. And to me, that left little room for an independent middle class to emerge. So how important is that in explaining the region's democracy deficit?
What an interesting question. So I think that it's absolutely true that the state played an unusually important role in Arab economies in the post-colonial period, but the state also played an unusually important role in culture and society in the states in the post-colonial period. There was a sort of Nasserist model, the corporatist model, didn't leave a lot of room for independent civil society, much less for free markets or free trade. And I think that in some of these countries, there was already a strong middle class, private sector prior to the end of colonialism, and it never really went away. It was subsumed, if you will, by a very, very powerful and increasingly bureaucratic state apparatus. And so I think what you saw in the years before the Arab uprisings is a sort of three-pronged strategy that kept these autocratic Arab regimes in power. One is that despite not allowing for a kind of broad-based private sector growth, a number of these states were able to live on rents that were either natural resources or foreign assistance rents, or in the case of Egypt, both foreign assistance and the Suez Canal, right? So you had rents kind of replacing the need for a government to generate domestic growth. It could get the revenue it needed to provide for public goods in other ways. The second component that I think lasted quite a long time in the Arab world was the role of ideology, Arab nationalism, Ba'athism, Nasserism, the struggle amongst ideologies in the Arab world. All of that was sustained really, I think, up until the 1990-1991 Gulf crisis. And then it's kind of started to come apart, or at least be laid bare in certain ways. And you saw that emerging in Arab intellectual discourse years before the uprisings. And then finally, there's, you know, the backstop of every autocratic regime, which is the repressive apparatus of the state. The uprisings in the Arab world really came at this moment, this opening that has now closed in many ways, I think, where the proliferation of 24-hour global satellite news coverage, the Web 2.0, and the rise of social media as a new force, all of this enabled a global spotlight on the protests once they began. And that really raised the cost to regimes of exercising the kind of repression that they might otherwise have done. So if Assad the father could do what he did in Hama in Syria in 1982 to put down an uprising led by the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, his son hesitated for quite a number of months before he exercised the same degree of force against Syrian citizens in 2011. Now, ultimately, Assad, the son, having watched Mubarak fall and Gaddafi fall and Ben Ali fall, said, oh, the answer here is to use my repression. That is my backstop. I'm going to go ahead and do that. And the result was that a peaceful protest movement ultimately was transformed into an insurgent movement, and Syria fell into a civil war from which it still suffers today. But it's all three of those. It's the economic rent, the ideology, and the repressive apparatus that started to fail in the early 2000s and enabled the uprisings to emerge.
You raised very important points, Tamara. And I want to, before I turn to Daron, I have a question about Turkey. But first, I want to talk about the Arab uprisings more. You served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Obama administration during this critical time, the Arab uprisings. And in the early days of the protests, debates about the relative importance of economic versus political factors permeated discussions about the motivations for the mass protests. And my question to you is, where did you stand on that debate? How important? You talked about these three things and the timing of the uprisings. But I want to go back to the issue of economic factors driving the protests, because in my own view, I think on the face of it, economic factors hold little explanatory value, because in the preceding decade, economic growth was not low in these countries, the so-called revolution countries, right? It was at about 4 to 5% of GDP per year. And then you had the youth unemployment. It was high in the Arab world, but this was nothing new. So in my mind, this couldn't also explain the timing of the protest. And the macroeconomic situation was also relatively stable. On the eve of the uprisings, international reserves were at comfortable levels, inequality was lower than in other regions. So I'm still to this day, I can't wrap my head around this idea that economic factors, I mean, what role did they play in the timing of the protests?
I think that there are probably in some specific cases, you could point to economic variables that generated shocks, that these systems having become more brittle and less effective, the shocks helped to catalyze what was already underway. But I think the broad trends were less about economics and more about the failures of these corporate estates to provide not just what citizens wanted, but to provide some of the basics. You know, so you can look at the drought in Russia that led to a spike in global grain prices and the impact that had on balance of payments in Egypt. And you could say, well, that was a shock to the system. Or the drought in eastern Syria that drove people into the cities looking for work. That was a shock to the system. And the system just wasn't very good at absorbing those. But I also think that there is something in the Arab uprisings that was evident from the very beginning that was just fundamentally about dignity, about human dignity. The younger generation then, first of all, it really was a demographic bubble, and they really were suffering from unemployment and lack of prospects that led to delays in marriage and other things that created real frustration. But I also think that there was a paternalism about the corporatist Arab state in the post-colonial period that a previous generation had been willing to accept that paternalism, and the younger generation simply wasn't. They wanted dignity. They wanted the state to treat them like partners, like citizens. And I think that's why incidents like the murder of Khaled Said, this young guy in Alexandria, Egypt, who was dragged out of an internet cafe by two state security guys and beaten to death on the sidewalk, why those events had such resonance. That wasn't about economics. That was just about human dignity.
Daron, what's your take on that? Do you agree with Tamara?
Well, I think I agree very much with Tamara's analysis of the Middle East, and I agree very much with her analysis of democracy, that it's, just like you said also, Gunil, that it's both cultural and economic factors. But I would go one step further, perhaps ending the agreement there. So I think what's relevant here is, in some sense, democracies have lost their legitimacy, partly because they did not perform as well as they promised, and partly because they showed that they had a bias for already powerful groups, either tolerating their corruption or facilitating their malfeasance, such as the financial sector in the United States, for instance, during the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, and thereafter. But also, I think on cultural issues, democracies have been completely incoherent. And this is, I think, an issue that we haven't really come to grips with. So democracy is based on the idea that people have at least some wisdom, that you have to take their views into account. They may be filtered. They are not directly ruling. It could be an indirect democracy. There could be some constraints due to sort of human rights and other things that are going to restrict what people's wishes translate into. But on some important issues, I think democratic rulers have been less interested or less willing to engage with people's concerns. And I think immigration is one of them. So it is clear, and it's been clear for a while, that much of the population, especially in the West, does not feel completely comfortable with large-scale immigration. But democratic governments haven't really had a very good conversation on this. You know, I wish, for instance, given my own sort of preferences and values, that, you know, the populations in France, Britain, the United States, Germany were more permissive to refugees, especially those fleeing war zones and threats to their lives or livelihoods. But given that they are not, how are democratic countries going to take a position on this? And I think the fact that they haven't clearly articulated a coherent position on this has created an opening for both far-right parties and more demagoguery coming from elected leaders. It's this combination together with democracy's failure on other things that has become symbiotic. Democracies, while at the same time they've been not delivering the sort of shared prosperity that they had promised, they're also turning a deaf ear to people's concerns about immigration. I think that's been a very dangerous mix. And I think we are not turning a corner there. You might look at what's happened in the UK and France and say, look, democratic center can hold. And I don't think that's necessarily the right lesson. In the UK, Labour won after 14 years of complete incompetence by the Tories, but thanks to the Reform UK party. Reform UK got a very significant fraction of the vote, and if that had stayed with the Tories, or the Tories had done what, say, the Republicans in the United States have accepted, which is sort of a completely anti-immigrant rhetoric, they could have remained in power, or they could have been neck and neck with Labour. In France, you know, the National Rally has been kept away from power, but only because the center and the left sort of entered into an alliance, strategically withdrawing candidates in the second round. And even then, it's the populist left, led by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, that's the energy center here. It's not the socialists, and it's not, you know, Macron's party. So I think we're not over this hump, and it's going to be very difficult for democracies to find the middle ground that sort of respects human rights, respects some amount of decency, but at the same time listens to people's concerns about cultural issues and immigration issues, and also communicates this effectively after, you know, the extreme right or the populist authoritarians have staked this ground for themselves.
Daron, you made a really important point. You're basically saying that immigration is one of the problems, why there's so much concern around the fate of democracies. Immigration is a huge problem, and democracies are not doing enough to ease people's anxiety. And there, Turkey presents a very interesting case. You have a government, a conservative nationalist government allied with an ultra-nationalist party, welcoming the Syrian refugees, embracing the millions of Syrian refugees. And you have a country which hosts the most, somewhere around 4 million, I think there are 4 million Syrian refugees living in Turkey. That's a huge number. And yet you don't see the rise of a far-right party like the one you see in Europe. You have Victory Party in Turkey, but I would expect Victory Party to secure a bigger victory in the elections, and that hasn't been the case. So to me, that's a very interesting thing to think about.
I would say there is actually, it's a more complicated situation in Turkey. And in fact, I would say Turkey, in my reading anyway, sort of fits a little bit of what I described, because if you look at the Turkish case, you know, first of all, Turkey did open its borders to refugees to an extent that pretty much no other country did. So that's to be noted, that's an important thing. But secondly, in Turkey, at least at first, the refugees were sort of not given work permits. They weren't allowed to sort of go to schools with natives. So it sort of slowed the effects. But the more important part is that it was the government, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who brought the refugees. He also had plans for perhaps giving them citizenship because he thought they would actually bolster his coalition. So his party and his loyalists did not raise this issue. The governing party and his coalition didn't raise this issue. And the center-left was silent on the issue of the refugees. But the population was becoming more and more concerned with these issues, and that's what opened up the room for something like the Victory Party. And even pressure built up on the center-left. So during the presidential campaign, for example, one of the most popular things that the leader of the opposition, Kılıçdaroğlu, did is when he turned against the refugees, and that was a big boost to his popularity, albeit a short-lived one, given other issues. So I think even in Turkey, despite the more sort of controlled way in which refugees were allowed into the country, I think the discontent is building up.
It is building up, but it wasn't until 2019. And that was when that really coincides with the beginning of Turkey's big economic problems. Up until then, if you look at the opinion polls, people, their main concern was other things, terrorism, economic problems. But then starting from 2018, 2019, the refugee issue became a huge problem for Turkish voters. Daron, you were born in Turkey and your time there informed your work. So I want to ask you a question about that. In your work, you argue that countries democratize not at random moments, but when they're having economic problems. So by that logic, one would expect Turkish strongman Recep Tayyip Erdoğan to lose last year's presidential elections, which were held at a time of serious economic problems. But he didn't. How do you explain that?
Look, you summarized my work extremely aptly. Indeed, there is a tendency for authoritarian regime and dictatorships to collapse when they are having economic problems. That doesn't, of course, mean that that's the only time they collapse, nor does it mean that every economic crisis is going to lead to the end of a dictatorial regime. But that being said, that was the reason why I, with many other commentators, were expecting Erdoğan to lose the presidential election. The economy was in trouble. It was very clearly the policies that Erdoğan himself advocated that were at least partly responsible for the economy's ills, including the very high levels of inflation due to his own sort of interventionist policies to keep interest rates low. Turkey had a very, very bad earthquake, and the death toll was tremendously high, and that was easy for everybody to see. And even though the government-controlled press did its best to package it in a way that wasn't bad for Erdoğan, many people understood that the death toll was so high, partly because of rampant corruption in building permits and associated deals at the local level, but supported by Erdoğan's party and by Erdoğan's bureaucrats. So you had the perfect storm for the ruling party. So I think it was a real surprise that Erdoğan survived. And he defies social science in some sense. But I think at the end, it just the opposition didn't find the right message. I think the issue with Kurds complicated the opposition coalition's unity, because the opposition coalition was bringing together the center-left with a nationalist party, the Good Party. So that was a very fragile coalition. And the fact that, you know, the government-sponsored press and AKP politicians continuously emphasized that Kurds were part of the coalition as well. In fact, they were going to be the main beneficiaries of the coalition, even though they weren't formally part of the coalition, I think created a lot of unease among nationalist voters to cast their ballot for the coalition's center-left presidential candidate. So I think there were a couple of potential explanations, but it was a real shocker.
But then he lost, right? He lost the recent municipal elections. And one might say, oh, it's just municipal elections. But actually, Erdoğan had turned the vote into a referendum on his rule. He campaigned heavily himself. So his party lost the municipal elections. I read it as it wasn't just a loss for the ruling AKP, but it actually showed his waning popularity. And the way I read it was that, in fact, a Turkish voters vote with their wallets.
Yeah, there are three interpretations, and I think it's too soon to say which one is valid. One is that the voters were really against, had already turned against Erdogan, but the opposition candidate was so uninspiring or there were other problems. That's why the presidential election didn't work out for the opposition, but the local elections were a second referendum, and there they spoke their two preferences. That's one interpretation. I'm not sure whether it's incorrect. We just don't have enough data to validate it. Second is that for the presidential election, Erdogan was able to pursue effective populist economic policies, including the minimum wage a lot, giving raises to retirees and civil servants. And he couldn't do that for the local elections because the situation was so bad that under his new sort of economy finance minister, Mehmet Şimşek, he started a normalization, a semi-normalization, and the same sort of largesse was not feasible anymore. And people, you know, vote with their short-term economic outcomes in mind, and that's why they did not have the same economic hardship just before the presidential election, and they were feeling that hardship before the local elections, and that's why they did it. And then the third one is people are unhappy with Erdogan to some degree, but they want to express that in elections that don't count so much and are not about directly about Erdogan, but about his, you know, second layer commanders in the municipalities. But when it comes for the presidential or the executive power, they still are not swaying from Erdogan. I don't think it's the third one, but I think one and two are equally likely. We just don't have enough data to adjudicate that.
Well, before I turn to Tamara, one last question on that, Daron. You mentioned Mehmet Şimşek, the new finance minister. He's widely respected by foreign investors and known for his orthodox economic approach. Can Mehmet Şimşek pull Turkey's economy back from brink? And if you think he can, what does that mean for the future of Erdogan's one-man rule?
I absolutely don't think he can. First of all, you know, that's the narrative you hear a lot in Turkey, that he's widely respected and orthodox, etc. But actually, when you look at the period in which the Turkish economic policy slipped into unsustainable populism, Mehmet Şimşek was the finance minister from, you know, I forget now, 2010 to 2018. I forget the exact dates now. That was also the period in which the Turkish economy performed really badly, had amazing potential, and none of that sort of got realized. So I don't think his track record is amazingly good either. And I think investors, of course, understand that things are a little bit better now, but they also know that ultimately Erdogan is in power and he has ultimate say. So I think the normalization is only partial normalization. And I don't think Turkey's economic problems are rooted in high inflation. High inflation is a symptom of a very unproductive economy that hasn't invested in new technology, that hasn't been competitive, it has not made workers more productive. There are a myriad problems that really require, you know, structural reforms, a much more open form of competition, more certainty and less sort of discretionary policies that are potentially threatening for businesses and especially foreign businesses. So all of those are the hallmark of Erdogan's presidency. He has become less combative on some of these issues lately, but there is no guarantee that he will stay that way.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're saying, in a sense, Turkey's economic problems are here to stay as long as Erdogan runs.
I would say even more. I think, you know, it wasn't clear to me that if the opposition came, they had a clear policy to turn around the economy either. You know, Turkey is underperforming relative to its young population position in the supply chain and geographic position. It still has very, very low productivity, and it has to increase that productivity in order to provide a much better living standard to its workers. And I think Erdogan's policies are largely responsible, but you really need a comprehensive change in economic policy and associated policies for this to turn. And it wasn't clear to me that the coalition divided within itself was going to be able to do that either. So I think it is here to stay, and it may be here to stay even with an alternative government, unless that government is strong enough and has sufficient public backing to undertake reforms to deal with that productivity problem.
So more depressing days ahead for Turkey. Tamara, I want to turn to you. You have written a lot on this. External support for authoritarian rule is a distinctive feature of the region, and so it's a key component of any explanation for the persistence of authoritarianism in the Middle East. You talk about the rentier economy, Western aid, usually Western aid and military support to these regimes in the region have strengthened regional autocrats and facilitated their repression of opposition groups. But the Obama administration actually wanted to shift the focus away from regime behavior, right, to expand other aspects of the relationship. For instance, through something called the Middle East Partnership Initiative. And you oversaw that initiative when you served in the administration. And there were others, such as Global Entrepreneurship Program and Presidential Summit on Entrepreneurship in the Muslim world. So through these efforts, the administration, the Obama administration, embraced the view that you need a strong middle class to have democracy. But here we are, and it seems like the U.S. can never get it right when it comes to the Middle East. So I want to ask you this. What is the single most important thing that the United States should do to help the region's pro-democracy actors?
Great question, Gunal, and I wish I had a simple silver bullet answer, but let me perhaps start by my answer by picking up on something that Daron said, because I think that his analysis of Erdogan's presidency and economic management of Turkey is actually a really, really good manifestation of why lack of transparency, lack of accountability ultimately dooms the efforts of unaccountable leaders to generate broad-based sustainable economic growth. Like in his early tenure, he made a lot of investments that had impact, like the transportation system and the education system. The longer he was in power, the more he was interested in preserving some of the special arrangements or lack of competition that certain elites valued, and economic management is suffering as a result. Now, if the policy shifted tomorrow, you would still have quite a lag before the economy responded to new policy signals. So no matter what the next government looks like, it's going to get blamed for, quote, not fixing the economy, unquote, in the short term, because there's always going to be a lag. And I think it's important for us to think about that, because oftentimes when you do have a democratic transition from authoritarianism, like in Egypt, you had 4 or 5% growth before the uprisings, Mubarak fell, and look, the economy didn't get better, it got worse. But that doesn't account for the failed, incomplete efforts at reform, the failure to follow IMF recommendations, the failure to allow a free private sector to operate in all the years before Mubarak fell. So I think we just have to put those economic outcomes in context. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, why did the Obama administration take this approach? Because the Obama administration understood that sustainable relationships between the United States and its most important counterparts in the region would not be done between individuals. They couldn't be driven by personalities. They couldn't rely on autocrats. Everybody's human. Nobody lives forever. And so if you want sustainable relationships with the United States, you have to build it people to people. That was the first realization, and that came well before the Arab uprisings. The second realization that also came before the Arab uprisings was about the importance of civil society. So, you know, again, going to Daron's point, if you want to change economic policy, it's not enough to just do it from the top. Where do solutions to these deeply entrenched problems come from? They can come from private sector actors. They can come from civil society actors. If you want an innovative society, a dynamic society, and a political system that can self-correct, you get that by having a vibrant civil society that is free to operate, free to speak, free to organize, free to engage with government. The Obama administration from the very beginning was focused on that. And I think you saw, for example, a speech by Secretary Clinton at the Community of Democracies in 2010, if I remember right, talking about the importance of civil society. So I continue to believe that sustaining relationships with and support for civil society in the Middle East is a deeply important, indeed essential, component for any U.S. policy that looks for a long-term relationship with the countries of the Middle East. And I also think that it's civil society that unleashes the self-corrective nature of democratic politics. You know, democratic politics don't always get fixed by parliaments or elected executives, but it can get fixed by civil society.
A great point, and I completely agree with you, Tamara. It's important for the U.S. to continue to work with civil society in the Middle East in general, but in Turkey in particular. Before we wrap up, Daron, I want to ask you a question about American democracy. First, let me ask you this. I'm sure you watched the debate, right? What's your take on Biden's prospects in November after the debate?
Let me say, since we're wrapping up, I also completely agree with Tamara's last point. In fact, I think the whole Middle East, including Turkey, are examples of modernization without civil society. And that's sort of also the theme that comes from the conceptual framework I try to develop in the book, The Narrow Corridor, with Jim Robinson, that, you know, state-society balance can be broken either because the state is too strong or civil society is too weak. And I think in the Middle East, it's the latter. It's civil society is too weak, state is too strong, rather than state weakness, although you have instances of state weakness as well, such as in Yemen or Lebanon. So civil society has to develop, but that also undercuts any easy solutions from the outside. You cannot build civil society by foreign aid, by foreign intervention, by foreign encouragement. Civil society has to develop by itself. And it's becoming more and more difficult when state is very powerful, is rich because of rents, oil revenues, and other things. And it also has more and more capable technologies for monitoring and surveillance. So there is no easy solution to that. And in terms of the U.S., I think this is a really critical election. The first Trump term was a true threat to democracy, but U.S. democracy survived. Not because its institutions are strong per se, but it just happened that there was enough popular mobilization, a few things held, and Trump himself was incoherent and badly organized. But the second term is going to be much more dangerous if it ever comes. So it's essential that there is a broad anti-Trump coalition that understands any alternative to Trump right now is worth supporting because you are voting for the survival of democracy here. That's the important thing. And I wish, you know, the Democrats had a more inspiring, younger, more energetic leader. But the question is, whatever you do at this point, you're not going to have a single candidate that gets everybody's support within the Democratic Party. So I think it's a can of worms to try to replace Biden right now, and that the media is having a field day by sort of fueling rumors about this or that. But I think ultimately it's counterproductive because the most important story here is the really true threat that Trump poses to democracy. And I think we should just focus on that.
I agree with you, Daron. But on the other hand, as a scholar studying Turkey last year, I was one of those who thought that the political context was ripe for an opposition victory. When the opposition fielded Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, I did not say anything publicly, but I was very nervous. And you know what happened. So I think candidate matters.
And I think those parallels are worrying me as well. And I may be making the same mistake because I had exactly the same view about Kılıçdaroğlu versus Erdogan. But there is one big difference, of course, which is that Biden has the incumbency advantage, which Kılıçdaroğlu did not. And so it was much easier to sort of destroy Kılıçdaroğlu and his coalition because all of the resources were in the hands of the government. So the same is not true in the U.S.
Good point. Yeah, very good point. One last thing on that, and then we have to wrap up. I am very critical of Biden's foreign policy, particularly the policy he pursued following October 7th attack. But I think he did a pretty decent job at home. American economy is doing well, but Biden is not getting credit for it from voters. And given the fact that around, I think, 60% of Trump votes in 2016 came from the white working class voters, what more should President Biden do to secure the backing of this group?
I think it's really, again, going back to these cultural issues. If you look at Biden's policies, they are a break with what Clinton and Obama did, and they're much more pro-working class, both in terms of what he's doing on trade, in terms of subsidies to manufacturing, his more overt support to unions, but not engaging with the cultural issues as much. And media is also portraying him to be much more pro-immigrant, open borders, etc., than he truly is. So that's, I think, one of the factors that's keeping the white working class away from the Democrats right now, and plus inflation. But I actually still hope that he will get the credit for really a very successful agenda. Three landmark legislations that, you know, are more major than pretty much anything that the previous three presidents passed. The CHIPS Act, the IRA, and also what he did in terms of combating the pandemic. That was very, very important. The job numbers, inflation numbers, but I completely agree. I think his foreign policy has been incoherent. On the other hand, the conventional wisdom is that American voters don't care so much about foreign policy.
That's true. Yes. So he has to do more on border security and immigration. Well, we have to end it there. Dr. Taron Acemoğlu, Dr. Tamara Wittes, it was a great discussion. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Gönül. Thank you, Tamara.
Be with you. Thanks, Taron. Great talking with you.
This has been a presentation of the Middle East Institute. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.